final sacrifice. It shattered against the mutated man's hip. The holy water soaked into those black robes and then burned the unholy thing from the inside. Unlike mundane pain, the sacrifice reacted to the divinely inflicted blow. It screeched like a banshee, smoke starting to rise from melting flesh. That was the opening Toby needed. The horizontal arc of the Minotaur's broadsword sliced under the sacrifice's arm and through most of the ribcage. The creature's muscles seized up, and it slowly slid backwards off of Toby's blade. I heard, rather than saw, Ames take their opponent down with an adder-quick thrust through the eye socket that left the tip of the cat's sword sticking out of the back of the human's skull. I heard Toby being helped over to lay hands on Will, and then urged to use healing magic on himself to save his arm. By the time anyone thought to check up on me, I had raised Rock above my head with both calloused green hands. For the seventh time, I brought my old friend crashing down on the priest's splintered skull, punishing the long-dead cleric for hurting my little friend. The shocked silence allowed me to get the eighth blow in. I was restrained by Rick and Ames as I raised Rock for the ninth time. Given my emotional state, Rick took charge. "Ames, go quickly and find the city guard. Tell them that army envoys have been injured fighting members of an apocalypse cult. Say that you need help securing the area right away, and you need backup from General Stanish Colton's people, including a combat medic. Just Stanish's people." The cat nodded and was gone in an instant. Rick was able to calm me down as I shook from fading anger and far too much adrenaline. I had enough intelligence left to help him pack and bandage Will's wounds as best we could. We also wrapped Toby's shoulder and leg tightly. The healing magic had gone a long way toward stopping the bleeding, and it almost certainly saved Will's life. His breathing was shallow but steady. We had a healing potion, but it was far too risky to try to force it down the small human's throat in his condition. Rick offered it to Toby, who said it would be a waste as he couldn't feel his arm anyway, and he was in stable condition. So, leaving Toby to cradle Will in his lap, the two of us searched the crypt. Hidden in a nook, there was a leather-bound diary. Rick confiscated it. There was a small chest, but it was just filled with ritual fetishes and simple weapons. We didn't loot the bodies, since they were evidence, and it might look bad if envoys of the Crown and Arcane University were caught patting down corpses. As I cleaned Rock with a flask of water and put my old friend away, Rick skimmed through the pages of the Dark Cleric's tome. He made it through several dozen pages while we waited for help. The tall human's eyes widened when he found a somewhat recent passage. "Listen to this." The human cleared his throat and started reading. "We have found an ally. Duke Harrington has always been a friend of the Order, but has now proven himself a friend of the cause. His reach and financial help will allow us to fulfill the will of Koroth, and soon we will strike a series of shrewd deals. These covenants will allow us to walk beside our demonic brethren in the flesh. The Duke's brilliant plan will open a path between realms. None of Panos will be spared. Praise be to Koroth." I grunted. "Don't think that enough for courts, but good start." Rick shook his head. "Where does one start when faced with the ravings of a zealot?" I said, "The money. Always the money." The tall human nodded and tucked the diary into his backpack. A short time later, Ames arrived with reinforcements from the city watch. They moved quickly to secure the crime scene and the temple itself. One look at the horribly mutilated demonic bodies was enough for them to take our side. A mustached and helmeted watchman said, "The general's men are on the way. Don't you worry." The guards went a step further than we did in our search. They cracked open the sarcophagi. Most of them only had skeletal remains, but there was an outcry when one of the newer vessels was opened. "'Tis the good witch Doris Pine! Fetch the inspectors!" We were told that a vexing missing persons case, now confirmed as a murder, had been big news recently. Doris Pine was a well-known magus in Royal Moffat. She had been an advocate for more transparency in the tax system, a vocal proponent of minimum pay being established for child labor, a provider of training for street thugs and criminals in order to rehabilitate them, and was the face of a number of other popular movements. A couple of weeks ago, she had disappeared, and blood was found at her residence. our mustached watchman told us. Let's get your wounded friends upstairs. This room is going to get crowded right quick. We carefully moved the human and Minotaur upstairs and met the general's men as they arrived in the temple's sacristy. The combat medics were able to cast a couple more minor healing spells on Toby and Will. With their help and under their protection, our group traveled to the temple of Aro-Remset. The clerics and paladins of Toby's temple immediately took our wounded friends in for convalescent care. We were complimented on stabilizing them so quickly and assured that they would be fine in a few days under the healing influence of Aro-Remset. Only upon hearing this news did Rick break down and start sobbing. He had held things together emotionally until Will was out of danger, but the near-death experience of his longtime partner clearly took a toll. Ames held her friend until the crying turned into relieved laughter. The human wiped his eyes and said, "It was his turn to do inventory when we get back home. He's not getting out of it this easily." Each one of us thanked the attending clerics, and then we rendezvoused with our guards who had been patiently waiting outside. They had sent a runner to report the situation up the chain of command and assured us that they were with us for as long as we needed them. Quickly, our group made it to the palace, still under military escort. We were greeted at the gates by none other than General Stanish Colton himself. He shook each of our hands. "I don't have all the details yet, but whatever you discovered sent Harrington into hiding. He's nowhere to be found in the palace. We've raided his quarters and are conducting a search right now. Come on!" The three of us were led to the private apartments in the north wing of the palace. Stopping just outside of the Duke's quarters, Stanish called for the commanding officer on the scene. The lieutenant that was leading the search saluted Stanish, and then reported. "There's no sign of him, sir. He did leave a brief note." The young officer handed over a scrap of parchment. After a parting salute, the young officer rejoined the search party. Grimly, the general read the note aloud for our benefit.
"It's already too late. You will burn."
Chapter 15. We made our report directly to the royal family, handing over the cultist's diary as the first piece of evidence against the Duke. The king was still in shock about the betrayal of his trusted advisor. The queen, of course, was already prepared for such news. Queen Ginger made it clear that our help was still needed.
"In light of this betrayal and the real probability of an ongoing conspiracy against the crown and against the people of Panos as a whole, we ask for your continued diligence. But if a plan has been set in motion by Duke Harrington and the doomsday cultists of Koroth must be discovered. If it is still a credible threat, their plans must be foiled. Our material aid will continue to be made available to you. Should you require financial or martial resources, you need but ask."
Putting her money where her mouth had just been, the queen issued Ames 50 gold coins to cover any research expenses. After taking our leave, we stopped at the front gate of the palace to get organized. I said, "Someone gotta tell Hematath. Rest gotta find out more stuff and things." Rick nodded. "I'll get word back to the headmaster, but Sorch, you need to rest and recover. It's dawn, and you're drained." I grunted. "No time. Kitty, look after me. We'll rest after next stop." Ames squeezed my shoulder.
"Where's that, Sorch?"
I pointed south. "Where all shady people go." As Rick headed back to the teleporter, we made our way to the docks. They were remarkably similar to the ones in Limpt, just on a more massive scale. We started with the public shipping manifest, trying to see if there was somewhere in particular that the Duke might run. I paused when I saw a certain name. "Blue Briar." My companion peered at the manifests.
"I don't see that ship on the manifest. What is it?"
I shook my head. "Not what. Who?" I poked a finger at the line of the manifest that I was talking about. "The Sea Devil, Captain Blue Briar, destination Limpt, Dock 43C. I explained, "He guy who shipped to Shaman for me. He friend of bartender I know. Got's eyes everywhere on coast." Ames glanced at the map hanging next to the manifest.
"Dock 43 is east of us. Let's go."
We made our way past over 100 ships of every size and shape imaginable. I still appreciated the ocean and those who sailed her. However, unlike the view from my apartment in Limpt, the sheer volume of ships made the Royal Moffat port seem horribly cluttered. Details were more difficult to pick out. A lot of the charm was lost. We reached Dock 43. The Sea Devil was easy to spot because, unlike most of the rest of the port, there were only a couple of ships in their berthings. As we approached, one of the human deckhands called down,
"What you fur, then?"
I shrugged and looked to Ames. The feline called back,
"We need Captain Blue Briar."
"So does every bitch in every port we visit, and they all leave satisfied but limping. This gonna be that kind of visit."
Instead of answering verbally, the werecat held up the small bag of gold that we had been granted by the crown. The feline jingled the coins loudly. The man peered down at us for a few long moments. Then he disappeared from the railing area. I frowned.
"If he come back with crossbow," Ames slapped my shoulder,
"we can dive under the boat. You can swim, right?"
"I no tell about silverfish."
"Wasn't that more pulling on a rope than swimming?"
I grunted.
"Sure, but yes, can swim."
Suddenly, there was an orc staring down at us. His salt-and-pepper hair was wild, as if the wind had been blowing it for years, and he never bothered to comb it. He had a green-gray complexion and brownish-blue eyes. The word that best described his overall appearance was salty. Blue Briar stared down at us, then focused all his attention on me.
"What you want?"
he barked in orcish. I answered in my native tongue.
"You know shaman in Jawafa clan, yes?"
The captain grunted.
"Yeah, so?"
"He friend. I send money to him with you."
The other orc's eyes widened a bit.
"Oh, you dat orc. Weirdo. Giving away shinies. What do you want?"
"Want your smarts. We'll pay."
Another grunt. Then the gangplank was lowered and we were welcomed aboard. Well, we were allowed on board. Captain Bluebriar took us into his cabin and closed the door. It was a small Spartan room. The walls were covered in maps and charts. Oddly, the room was lit by a blue glass canary sitting on the captain's desk, enhanced with a light spell. I figured that, much like my pot, this was one of those minor magic items that apprentice mystical craftsmen make. It cast the entire room in an azure hue. The other orc switched to the common tongue for Ames's benefit.
"Don't need spare change. Help crazy orc as pity case. Ask."
I wondered if after so many dealings over the years, this orc had developed a friendship with shaman and I was reaping the benefit. I didn't question our good fortune aloud, however.
"Koroth cult in bed with Duke. Duke on run now, but say bad things gonna happen. You hear about bad things?"
The captain looked between Ames and myself, then sighed.
"Should have known it'd be dangerous question. Yeah, heard about bad things."
My feline companion rumbled smoothly.
"It goes no further than this. Nobody will know you spoke to us. What bad things?"
The other orc rubbed his chin.
"Dunno detail. Just know leaving in morning before all goes wrong. Listen. Parade perfect time for thief, yes? People, money, tourists. Then why thieves leave city? They know what we dunno."
I tilted my head.
"Thief tell you dis?"
Bluebriar nodded.
"And I see with own eyes. Flood of scum pay for ship out. I tell other ships around, they go. Soon next dock here and next, they all go. Fine for early leave, nothing compared to dying."
Ames asked, "Are there any thieves left that we could persuade to give us details?"
The captain smiled suddenly, perhaps seeing an opportunity to get a little payback.
"Yes. Oh, yes, one. You say you got gold, yes?"
Because of the nature of this potential informant, half of our research money ended up going to the captain as a matter of formality. After getting the name and description of our target, we bid Bluebriar a good voyage and left the docks. The two of us headed just north of the warehouses and fish processing plants to where the bulk of these big buildings created a perpetual shadow. I stayed far behind Ames so that my less subtle nature wouldn't intrude on the feline's expert skulking. It was well into the afternoon now. After hours of stalking and hunting, we found our quarry. If you were to pass this particular human on the street, you might consider frequenting higher quality streets. The mousy brown hair, pocked face, and often broken nose did the man no favors. He was leaning up against the side of an abandoned warehouse, waiting for someone. I approached him from the right, not bothering to hide a menacing glare. Those sharp eyes widened. The human turned to run, but ran headlong into a mass of fur and leather. Ames snarled,
"Hello, Earl. Blue Briar sends his regards."
And with that, the werecat drove their short sword 3 inches into the human's left leg. The man screamed and fell down on his ass, raising both hands to shield his face from what he presumed was an oncoming beatdown. Ames rolled their eyes and slowly extracted the blade from Earl's cedar peg leg. When no pain followed the attack on his false limb, the lowlife peeked out from between his fingers. I had joined the werecat at that point, folding my arms across my chest and peering down at the pitiful excuse for a human.
"What do you want? I told Blue Briar I'd pay him back. It only 20 lousy gold. I would have had it to him last week, but he weren't here and I spent it on, my next batch of product."
I looked at Ames and said gutturally, "Let me crush it." The werecat smiled, all sharp teeth and malice.
"Not yet, killer. Let's see if he plans to be useful."
Ames crouched a bit so that the human's vision was mostly filled with pearly white fangs.
"We bought your debt from Blue Briar for 25 gold after factoring in the vig. We paid a premium because we really wanted to have this little chat with you. If you prove yourself useful, we'll forget about your debt to us entirely. If not, I feed you to him."
Ames jerked a fuzzy thumb up at me. I commented, "I likes the eyeballs best." The human quickly made efforts to get on our good side.
"Oh, of course. You tell me what you need, I'll make sure it happens."
Ames straightened their back and then imitated my posture by folding those fuzzy arms over their chest. The swaying of that fluffy white tail was a slight distraction for me, but Earl was wholly focused on Ames's words.
"The rats are fleeing the ship, Earl. There's no way all of these lowlifes are leaving town just before every tourist, noble, and country bumpkin floods into town. Not unless something big and unfortunate was happening. What is it?"
Now Earl looked truly frightened.
"If anyone knows that, you heard it from me."
He trailed off into silence. I asked Ames, "I eats now?" The man quickly made up his mind.
"This festival thing is bad news. Everyone's getting out of town because we hear there's going to be a body count, see? Some kind of magical trap or something can't be avoided. It's supposed to be an inside job. So you see, there's no leverage for us. It's all danger, no upside. I'm on a wagon out of here tonight after I dump the rest of my product."
I frowned.
"How you know trap magical?"
Earl looked surprised. I might have been breaking character a little bit by showing that much intelligence, but he was already terrified of us, so he answered rapidly.
"'Cause that bigwig that's on the run, that Duke guy, he was hiring guys like us, but only if we knew magic."
Ames turned to me.
"Like the illusionist spy?"
I replied.
"Doris Pine."
The feline's eyes widened.
"She worked with street criminals to try to rehabilitate them. The woman even taught some of them the basics of magic so that they might pull themselves out of the gutters. She would have known exactly the types he wanted to hire. Might have even been mistaken for a potential recruit on the streets. She found out."
"Died for it."
We both looked back down at the peg-legged human. Earl looked back up at us, owlishly.
"So, can I go now?"
We cut the human loose and hurried back to the palace. The king and general were both unavailable, but the queen was happy to see us right away. We met in our staging area. When we told her that the Arcane University's celebration might be the stage for a massacre, she was not happy. The country-born monarch drawled,
"Y'all convinced me, don't worry.
But I can hardly send millions of folks packing because someone somewhere might be fixing to blow some of them up. It would be chaos. Hundreds would die, tens of thousands robbed or worse, and seeing an evacuation, they might just start killing innocents while they scamper anyhow.
She had several good points. Ames paced between the rows of beds.
We don't have specific names for you, or how they plan to do it, but you're right. We have no idea what happens if we cancel the celebration. It's probably safer if the enemy is unaware how close we've come to the truth. We need to find the real threats.
Ginger nodded.
I'll order the army to help the city guard. We'll start with hunting street crooks who are still around. That ain't out of character before a big celebration. We catch the right ones, I reckon they might lead us up the ladder.
I grunted. We get all back together. Find way to hunt them down. Got list of components needed.
The queen paused, concerned by my primitive manner of speech.
Get some rest, sugar. I'll get word to Hematath, get your mage friend sent back, and I'll send carriages to scoop up your other two companions and whatever you need on that there list. Everything and everyone will be here early in the morning.
I was about to protest, but Ames squeezed my shoulder. A gentle nod was all it took to convince me that the werecat's judgment was probably better than my own right now. Ginger gave Ames a little peck on the cheek. Then the monarch took my list of material components and made her exit. I laid down in the nearest bed and fell asleep within minutes. The drain and lack of rest had both taken their toll, leaving my mind helpless to defend itself against the vivid nightmare that assailed me. When the engine consumed the world this time, I actually felt relief. At least the oblivion would end the nightmare and allow me to rest.
Chapter 16. I slept for a solid 13 hours. By the time I cracked my eyes open, the fourth floor of the Southwest Tower was filled with people. Very loud people. Will was insisting that these very loud people leave him alone.
I'm telling you, I've had two nights and a full day of being bombarded with healing from clerics and paladins and traditional medics, and I think even a wandering shaman. Leave me be! Oof!
The oof was probably because I had slipped out of bed and given the little human a huge bear hug. He squirmed until I finally let him go.
Alive! Good!
I said hoarsely. Rick snickered.
He is, unless you squeeze the life out of him. Why don't you do your preparation and intellect enhancement sort? I didn't come up with much at the university, but we're organizing what little information we have.
After a full round of enhancement, I felt much more like myself. The king sent up a regal breakfast, along with apologies that he had been busy with military matters yesterday. I asked if the army activity was pertinent to our investigation. The messenger informed us that there was an unknown militia in the northeastern territories. As that was Duke Harrington's lands, they had to respond immediately, but when they arrived, the force had already fled. We thanked the herald and enjoyed a feast of eggs, bacon rashers, fried carrots, a light and refreshing chilled honey wine. Dessert was preserved peaches, of course. Well fed and fully rested now, I was up to helping the others to pore through the records that the Arcane University had collected on our wayward Duke. One particular piece of information jumped out at me. It says that he lost his arm and got his scars in a magical attack on the family's carriage. The same attack killed both his parents, Mary and Horace Harrington. Witnesses say that it was like a fireball, but with solid force behind it. It splintered the carriage, killed the horses, severed the Duke's arm, and threw his unconscious body from the blast. Toby said,
"Wait."
We waited. It was a few moments before he said anything else. The Minotaur murmured,
"What if?"
He cleared his throat and then said more loudly and with more confidence,
"What if it wasn't an attack at all? In one fell swoop, Marley goes from regal fop to the most powerful landowner south of Ice House, but it cost him his arm. It cost him his arm."
Rick thumped the dining table.
"As a sacrifice to Koroth, maker of bargains. I don't think we can prove it, but given recent events, you may well be right, Toby."
The Minotaur nodded.
"That means the evidence of his corruption might go back years."
We all took a moment to let that sink in. Our task might have gone from monumental straight to impossible. I made the executive decision. Celebrations start tonight. We need to work with what we have and hope that there's something useful here. We spent another hour learning everything we could about Duke Harrington. He was never known as a combatant or spellcaster. He was a shrewd businessman that relied on spies and intelligence networks to be effective. As useful as it was to know one's enemy, we were no closer to figuring out his grand scheme. Will mentioned,
"We should consider setting a stop point. If we don't have anything solid, Toby will need to help his order prepare. We'll be more useful on the street, ready to react to any threat. Rick and I have been asked to replace a couple of mages who haven't shown up for their role in the celebration, so we can be right in the thick of things."
It was my turn to say, "Wait." All eyes turned to me. The celebration, the Good Witch, recruiting underworld mages, access to somewhere under the castle. More mages gone missing. I rolled it around in my head. A gathering of arcane power, a cover-up, and my nightmare. My nightmare. No. I murmured the word with a sudden, sickening realization. I felt a paw on my shoulder. Ames was shaking me gently.
Sort? What is it?
I snarled. No. I'm so stupid. Hematath was wrong, my nightmare. It wasn't some kind of allegory about power corrupting and a great evil. It wasn't even about the voodoo engine. It was the rest. The others. I turned to Rick and Will. Right now, where are the arcane siphons? Of the 11 used to build the arcane university, I know where exactly one is. The voodoo engine in the middle of my village. Where are the rest? Rick turned to Will. Neither of them had an answer. I insisted. We need to know now, right now. Toby, when they picked you up, did they pick up a bunch of components from a list? The Minotaur cut me off. It's on the third bed on the left, Sorge. I rushed out of the kitchen area briefly to grab the bag of material components that Ginger promised. As everyone looked on, I took out a strand of copper wire. Closing my eyes, I murmured the incantation for Max's message. Keeping the image of Hematath in my mind, I sent, "Need help. Need to know where every arcane siphon is right now. Celebration may be trap. Possibly traitors in university." Moments later, I got the reply. "Siphons building infrastructure for celebration in United Dibbon, Limpt, Ice House, Royal Moffat, Eastern Hook. I'm coming to you." I related what I sent and the headmaster's reply aloud. "Rick, Will, if there are siphons in the city, can you find out where they are supposed to be deployed? I assume for building platforms, clearing parks, building footbridges. Are they accounted for?" Will nodded. "We're on it." The pair hurried to find and ask the court magician, who would have likely been informed of such an undertaking. I ran my fingers roughly through my hair. "Toby, Hematath is teleporting in. Could you meet her at the front gates and bring her back here?" When he had gone, I slammed a fist into the table. And again, Ames restrained my arm and said, "Stop." I sighed. I had all the pieces of the puzzle yesterday. Why didn't I see it? The feline reminded me.
"You were running on no sleep and nearly fully drained of your enhanced intellect. Nobody else put it together either. And you didn't know about the disappearing mages until just now, assuming you're right. What does this mean?"
I gripped my teeth. "One or more incredibly powerful artifacts have been stolen by traitors inside of the Arcane University, hidden in places unknown, and they're about to be used as a force of mass destruction." Ames blinked.
"Oh."
I furiously scribbled every detail, every assumption, and every guess down on a piece of parchment, just in case I was wrong and we had to rethink the situation. By the time I was done, people were arriving. All of them looked somber. Toby and Hematath arrived, followed seconds later by Rick and Will.
"Update me, Sorge," ordered the headmaster in a polite tone.
I had never seen her in adventuring gear. Even after a few hundred years, the Archmage looked at home with a backpack, belt pouch, and high-laced boots. I took a deep breath. "If I'm right, we're about to be told that nobody has any idea where the arcane siphons are in Royal Moffat." Rick said grimly,
"Nobody has any idea where the arcane siphons are in Royal Moffat."
I sighed once again. Headmaster, I'm afraid that the mages who have gone missing, as well as some who have access to controlling the teleportation system, are enemies of the Arcane University. At least 2 arcane siphons are missing, possibly every single one save for the voodoo engine at my village. We need to start ferreting out the traitors and seeing if we know where any of the siphons are currently. The pale elf grew more pale as I explained the situation. I started to walk her through my logic, but she stopped me, already convinced. Hematath murmured,
I'll contact Max. He'll contact the other major cities, but assume you're right.
I nodded. If I'm right, up to 10 arcane siphons are somewhere underneath us right now. They've probably been enhanced by Koroth, and because they're all grouped up together, they also enhance each other. The goal being to siphon magic from a huge area, perhaps half the city or even the entire city. When the celebration starts, they can be used to dig out the supports under the castle, collapse roads, break the seawall, and leave Royal Moffat's remains in a smoking or flooded crater. I held up a hand to forestall the obvious next suggestion. And if we cancel the celebration, a small army of criminals and traitor mages will start unleashing arcane destruction on the city. That will leave us either fighting back with mundane means only and losing, or fighting back with magic and helping to feed the siphons anyway. Will cursed.
And we have no idea where they are.
Hematath provided a glimmer of hope.
I may be able to find them, but I need to prepare a personal teleportation spell, and I need the help of your friend, Sorch, the one you call Shaman.
That was the last name I expected to hear. Shaman? Why? How can he help? The headmaster explained,
All of the arcane siphons are identical artifacts. They have the ability to link with each other and work together. That includes your voodoo engine. If your friend can get me in close proximity of it, I can use that as a way to find the others. All of them, their exact positions. But he needs to disguise me, shelter me, and give me a place to recover so that I can return home safely.
Will asked,
Can you use that link to change their task?
The elf shook her head.
For that you still need to touch them, or at least one of them assigned to a particular task in close proximity. Direct access is the only way to shut them down.
I nodded. Okay, I'll prepare Max's message for Shaman. If I was right, this would mean that I wouldn't have many major offensive spells for the upcoming battle, but it needed to be done. We'll all rest, meditate, and prepare to end this one way or the other. People in key positions need to know that although we're pretending to go through with the parades, we won't be using any more magic in the streets until we're forced to respond. Ames, Toby, we need to tell the general, and the king, and the paladins, and... Ames summed it up with,
Everyone.
Toby nodded. We'll go tell everyone. As I saw Hematath take out a strand of copper wire, I mentioned, If they're zealots, they might be impossible to find before they strike. But if they're not zealots, they aren't working for free. Tell Max to follow the money. The headmaster gave me an odd little smile. But without further comment, she performed the incantation and sent a message to Max. Then, we rested. It seemed strange to be laying down, having just discovered that a horrifically powerful force was going to tear the entire city apart. While squadrons of guards and soldiers were being quietly deployed, and the biggest celebration in modern history was being stealthily cancelled, we were all taking a nap. It was absolutely necessary, but at the same time somewhat ludicrous. Once we had memorized the spells that we needed in order to make the plan work, I opened up my notebook to share sketches of the village and even a drawing of Shaman's tent with Hematath. I pinpointed the location on a continental map and described all of the nearby landmarks. The aged elf needed to be as intimately familiar with the area as possible to avoid teleporting to the wrong location, or, gods forbid, into solid rock. As the headmaster studied, I used Max's message to contact my oldest, dearest friend. Need help? Sending elf archmage. Hide and protect her. Get her near voodoo engine. She can save us all. Save the world. The mental reply was near immediate. You crazy, but fine. Better to be crazy in saved world than uncrazy in destroyed world. I protect your elf. Hematath's eyes were distant as she dealt with her own message.
Max got the reports back. All of the siphons are missing. Our loyal people are helping to track down the traitors.
I rubbed my eyes. 10 siphons, then. All right.
Shaman is with us. He's awaiting your arrival. The Archmage nodded.
Do you have anything with you that came from the area? It would greatly increase the accuracy of the teleportation spell.
I reached into my pouch. Hematath was now the proud guardian of Rock. Best of luck, Headmaster.
To us all, Sorch.
We all watched as the elf stood as still as possible. There were no gestures, no material components, just the murmuring of an incantation that would transport Hematath halfway around the planet. The last syllable of her spell drifted across the room, and in an instant, she was gone. Soon after, a message started to come to me. At first I was confused, since there was no way that the headmaster had already accomplished her mission. Then I realized it was Max. Followed the money. Caught pair that teleported siphons. Once we are secure, we'll send more help. Happy hunting. I sent the reply. Thanks, Max. Hematath at my village, using voodoo engine to find siphons. We'll need to rest after to teleport back. Good luck. I said aloud as we all got suited up, Max's people caught the traitors who teleported the arcane siphons via the university. He'll send help in a few hours after they clean up their own mess. Toby snorted. There might be nothing to teleport to in a few hours. We packed everything that might be useful, leaving all non-essentials behind, and headed down the tower stairs. The front gates of the palace seemed to be as good of a place as any to gather. It was central, with quick access to members of both the City Watch and the General's people. The King and Queen arranged for two carriages and a mounted unit to be at our command. We kept a watchful eye out for anyone who might be trying to cause trouble. After half an hour of pacing and idle complaining, something happened. Will stopped moving and looked out towards the horizon, eyes unfocused. A few seconds later, he relayed the gist of the message.
It sounds like all 10 of them are in an underground cave below the sewers. The entry point to the main cavern is directly under the open market on the west side of the city.
Toby turned to the corporal who was standing with us. Do you know where that is? The soldier nodded.
Gully Circle, sir. There's sewer access, but I'm not sure about the caves.
The Minotaur nodded. You and your men come with us. I told the gate guard, tell the king and the general where we're going, and to send help when they have the spare people available. The five of us piled into the carriages. Our mounted escort took us west at a fair gallop. The sound of shod hooves on cobblestone was so loud, we didn't even hear the first explosion. A series of sinister magical attacks had been launched. The sound of the first conjured horror triggered the next rogue mage to unleash their devastation, and so on, until smoke and thunder rolled through the once placid city streets. As we raced to stop the Duke's plans, his hirelings raced to fuel the arcane siphons while causing as much chaos as possible. I tried to calculate our odds, but there were too many unknowns. I just hoped that Shaman and Hematath were safe, and I hoped that we would have a chance, no matter how slim, to make a difference before the end came. Chapter 17. We reached Gully Circle, a broad outdoor market. The center of the cobblestone circle was littered with carts of wares, ranging from foodstuff to handcrafted goods. It was surrounded by converted warehouses, serving as additional merchant space. When rain fell, the peddlers could still take shelter indoors. Today they were trying to weather a different kind of storm. The crackling of a nearby lightning bolt had already sent merchants and customers alike scurrying for cover. Our escort acted with the kind of precision that one might expect from the most powerful standing army in the southern hemisphere of Panos. Our four mounted archers covered the roads into the circle, while the two pikemen started patrolling the perimeter. The battle mage and medic found centralized cover near a stack of crates and dug in. Our remaining four swordsmen, one of them being the unit's corporal, led us over to the sewer entrance and pried up the heavy iron lid. The corporal said, "We'll hold your exit and make sure you have a way out if you need it. Best of luck." Toby squeezed the man's shoulder and then threw his pack to me. I grunted under the weight, but swiftly realized why he did it. Although the sewer entrance was wide by our standards, it was a very tight fit for the Minotaur. He did make it, though, after a brief struggle. I dropped his pack in, which was deftly caught. Then I climbed down the metal ladder that had been bolted to the sewer wall.
The smell was what you would expect, but not as intense as I had imagined. Once Will and Rick joined us and cast light on their marker sticks, I understood why. The water and sludge were barely an inch deep, the remainder draining rapidly for some reason. Ames was the last to drop in, but the first to comment. The feline noted, "We should go with the flow. If they've really bashed through the sewer wall or floor to reach some caves, it's unlikely that they had the time to seal things properly behind them." Sewage normally flowed to designated areas of the ocean, which meant it should be traveling either south or west, but the flow in this stretch was oozing its way north. Not only had something been damaged, but the entire passage had sunk at least a few inches. The party trudged northwards as rapidly as we dared. We found ourselves alone, save for a rat or two. 50 paces up the tunnel, the only thing that had changed was the sound. A kind of rushing, churning din was growing in our ears. When the radius of our light reached the source of the noise, we understood why. The sewage coming from the north was plummeting downwards, like a foul waterfall. Whatever magics used to open the tunnel were unsubtle, to say the least. Perhaps this was the work of arcane siphons. Perhaps it was a mad geomancer. Either way, the ground had been cracked, lifted, and then torn asunder. Once the bare rock had been exposed, a steep tunnel was conjured to join the sewers to the natural cave network, situated below us and to the east. We continued to follow the flow of sewage, careful not to slip. If any one of us fell and were swept away by the muck, there was no telling what danger that person would encounter. The arcane passage gave way to a natural cavern. This chamber was at least 10 paces high and easily wide enough for 15 men to walk shoulder to shoulder. Sewage poured onto the rocky floor before draining into the southern chamber and beyond the radius of our light. We had no plans to follow it, however, as we were far more interested in the sounds coming from the other direction. Together we navigated the slight incline as the party moved towards the danger, a tendency often observed in the insane, the foolhardy, and adventurers. As the broad cavern curled in a northeasterly line, a field of light could be seen in the distance. A mix of mundane torches and light spells cast on rocks left us no shadows to skulk in. With a resigned sigh, Ames moved to the front of our group and stood shoulder to ribcage with the much taller paladin. Rick and Will tucked away their light sticks, as they were about to become redundant. Just as we were going to enter the well-lit area, 2 humans appeared at the far side of the chamber, seemingly materializing from the left-hand wall. Apparently, there was a sharp turn into another cave or tunnel that we couldn't quite see yet. We crouched and held very still, taking advantage of the surrounding darkness and the frailness of human eyesight. Humans only see within their somewhat narrow visible spectrum, so when standing in the light and trying to peer into the shadow, they were nearly blind. The 2 warriors moved dangerously close. We saw every detail of their scale mail armor, the quality of their bastard swords, even the manner in which they tied their boots. The man in the lead stopped suddenly. It might have been because of the short sword jutting from his neck, or the broadsword piercing his lung. It's difficult to tell. The second man started dancing in place as 2 full sets of magic missiles pummeled him from short range. My thrown dagger embedding in his abdomen didn't help the human's situation any. Both of them fell to the cave floor noisily. Quite dead. We unsheathed our weapons from the 2 bodies and sprinted as quickly as possible through the well-lit cave. Sure enough, this cavern linked to another via a short downward-sloping tunnel that was unnaturally round and smooth. We half-ran, half-slid down the connecting tunnel. It would have been a bad place to get trapped. The next cave stretched to the northeast about 40 paces. It was lit entirely by magic, as evidenced by the lack of fire's telltale flickering. I wish I could say that we were the only occupants of this chamber, but I haven't lied yet, and I don't intend to start now. Of the 4 sacrifices waiting for us, 1 caught my eye immediately. The naked minotaur that faced us had jet-black fur from horns to hooves. Only it wasn't exactly fur. Each patch of the glossy, warped stuff seemed to be petrified. It was as if strands of hybrid wood and stone had grown from the forsaken creature's flesh. If this thing was ever a man, there was no evidence of it, and gender had long since ceased to be a function of that twisted body and mind. It carried only a stylized battle axe, ancient runes seeming to crawl over its surface like living things. It was smiling. Standing at the deformed minotaur's side was a humanoid of indeterminate species. The head had been twisted into... a neck-mounted, three-sided pyramid would be the most accurate way to describe it. Each facing had a set of dead, pupil-less eyes and a toothless mouth that gaped open and drooled. The rest of the thing's body was as normal as could be expected. It was protected by a suit of ragged hide armor made from some kind of humanoid flesh. The creature wielded a simple longsword. At the midpoint of the cavern stood twin orcs that had undergone the same roasted skin treatment that we had seen before, making their bodies red and leathery. They had hand crossbows at the ready and short swords sheathed at their sides. And, standing behind them all, at the far end of the chamber, was the Duke. He was still dressed in crimson and gold, albeit a bit grubbier from his underground excursions. He wore no weapon and didn't look like he wanted any part of the upcoming conflict. The human called out from the far side of the cave, still using those annoying, overpronounced tones.
"I'm afraid you've arrived a bit too late. The mages up above have been most productive. They're waiting for a sign to evacuate the city before the end arrives, but I think that would be terribly boring. Besides, everyone needs to make sacrifices if we're to move forward in this life. Believe me, I know."
With that, he turned to his left and disappeared around a sharp bend at the far side of the cave. Will, in a very heads-up display, was already casting his first spell as Duke Harrington was finishing his taunt. He stepped in front of Rick and myself and held his ground. Twin crossbow bolts shattered against his invisible shield, giving us time to act. Ames was squaring off, uncomfortably, against the pyramid-headed abomination. Toby stepped up to the naked minotaur with confidence. I thought that he would be enraged or betrayed and crying, but the paladin was smiling. This was a worthy foe. I decided that since I had given up most of my offensive magic for utility, I would follow Will's lead and summon a shield. But unlike the small human, I then advanced on the two crossbow-wielding sacrifices. Their fire was split now, as the leftmost orc tried to shoot at me under my invisible shield, but only accomplished sticking a bolt through the leather of my boot, missing flesh altogether. The other pinged a shot off of Will's shield once again. Rick's spell went off, but it wasn't one I had ever seen before. I guess I wasn't the only one learning new tricks at the Arcane University. A cluster of huge hailstones shot out of a portal that appeared upon one of the cave walls, pummeling the face and chest of the orc on the right. He screamed. The projectiles were not only hard and fast, but unnaturally cold. At least we knew that these two could feel mortal pain. Toby wasn't faring as well. The first few testing strikes from each minotaur resulted in easy parries and blocks, but the first real blow from the sacrificed beast tore a metal shard from Toby's shield. The act of blocking it numbed the paladin's arm from shoulder to wrist. The overhanded counterattack from the golden brown bull was easily sidestepped. Following a moment of wary circling, the next attack from the black beast created a visible nick in Toby's broadsword. Toby's counter bounced off of that petrified ebony fur, kicking up a small cloud of dust, much like crushed coal. My friend's smile had faded. Ames was having a different set of difficulties with the abomination that they were faced with. The movements from the weirdly shaped sacrifice seemed mechanical, almost clockwork. The exaggerated swings and almost comically over-executed dodges of this creature opened up huge gaps in its defenses. But every time Ames tried to take advantage, it was a trap. There was a longsword swinging at the feline's neck or chopping towards their wrist, and when Ames dodged to one side or rolled, another pair of dead eyes was tracking the feline's movements. Any minor blows that the cat managed to land were turned aside by the sacrificed's tough hide armor. White fur was already stained red with a couple of minor cuts that had slashed through the werecat's own leathers. Ames parried and dodged, trying desperately to solve this puzzle. The orc that I was approaching let his hand crossbow hang from a leather strap around his shoulder, opting instead to draw his short sword. Immediately, I started backpedaling towards my friends. The red-skinned orc stared at me in disbelief and anger as the sacrifice realized I was simply wasting his time. He had to make a decision: go back to the crossbow or stay with the sword. As my orc was frozen with indecision, the other red-skinned humanoid was struggling to reload their weapon. He never got the chance. Rick's lightning bolt stopped the creature dead. Will dropped his shield and started casting a quick spell. For the second time this afternoon, he caused magic missiles to rain in on a foe. The surviving sacrificed orc howled in pain and outrage. Toby's mouth was bleeding from the axe handle that struck him across the snout. None of the golden-brown minotaur's strikes had penetrated the strange fur armor of his opponent. At best, he had bruised and winded the large sacrifice, and even that was hopeful thinking. The next blow from the naked creature completely shattered Toby's shield, sending metal shrapnel everywhere and cutting his hand in the process. My werecat companion looked tired, bleeding from multiple shallow cuts, and no closer to besting this vexing foe. Ames stumbled after a desperate dodge, creating the opening that the pyramid-headed sacrifice needed. That longsword flashed forward in a vicious stab, but the stumble was a trap, and the cat was already spinning to their right. Sadly, the stab was a feint, and quickly became an upward slash that threatened to tear into Ames's leg. Brilliantly, the werecat predicted the feint into the trap. Planting their pivot foot, Ames committed. The feline stepped inside the effective arc of the sacrificed creature's blade, and its wrist impacted ineffectually against the cat's kneecap. The pyramid-headed abomination was low and overextended. With a feral snarl, Ames used both hand paws to drive the sword point down at their foe's exposed back. The spine was severed, and the sacrifice moved no more. The remaining orc saw two unshielded, unarmored mages and came to a decision. The sacrifice charged, sword point leading. I quickly ran at the red-skinned orc's side with my invisible shield raised. We impacted just two strides from Toby and Will and fell to the cave's stone floor in a heap. I was dazed. It took me a few moments to realize what was going on. In a most unmage-like display, Will and Toby had piled on to the fallen orc. They were punching and kicking him as he tried to recover from our impact. Soon I was joining my friends, little dagger flashing as the three of us pinned and dispatched our enemy the old-fashioned way. The black-furred minotaur must have realized that it was the last one standing. But if Toby was defeated, it was quite possible that the rest of us wouldn't be able to withstand the sacrifice's furious assault. With a demonic bellow, the mutated creature swung its heavily enchanted axe at Toby's chest, looking to chop through blade, fur, flesh, and bone. The paladin's sword shattered, sending shards of steel through the air that sliced his face and neck. The golden-brown furred minotaur stepped to the left as the impact happened, and the axe barely missed his right shoulder. With a bellow of his own, Toby thrusted with the jagged foot of steel that still remained attached to his sword's hilt. It pierced mutated fur and leathery flesh to find the sacrificed minotaur's dark heart. Runed axe fell from numb hands. The final sacrifice slowly toppled over, dying with a puzzled look on its face. Almost by instinct, Toby bent to replace his broken weapon with the implement of his fallen foe. The minotaur's eyes widened as he got a good look at the axe's blade for the first time.
"This is..."
The paladin's words were cut off by the sudden earthquake that shook the chamber so violently nobody remained on their feet.
"This way!"
I yelled after the tremor had passed. I scrambled to my feet and charged towards the corner where the Duke had made his exit, trusting my friends to follow. The final two chambers of the cave network were surprisingly small, relative to the one that we just came from. The cavern farthest from me contained what we were seeking, a tight stack of arcane siphons, 10 strong. There was a circular opening that led from that final chamber into the larger cave that I had just stepped into. The problem was, of course, the giant earth elemental that was rolling a boulder over the entryway. It was twice the size of Toby, with a crude granite head that nearly scraped the top of the cave. I didn't have a single spell that could affect that thing. Well, maybe one, but that scenario was wishful thinking. I should say, the elemental was the big problem. The two smaller problems were the Bishop of Koroth in all of his demi-demonic glory and Duke Harrington standing in an abjuration circle. The Bishop of Koroth was purple. There's really no other way to describe him. His deep purple skin was likely the result of rituals similar to what the sacrificed had to endure. However, there was no evident defects on Koroth's high priest. He held his ornate golden staff firmly, watching me. Waiting. The Duke was completely ignoring everything else in the room. He simply stood in his magic circle and prayed aloud to Koroth for a meaningful and beneficial bargain. It wouldn't be a real barrier to any of us. But in the case of Celestials and Demons, it would act as a brick wall. Of course, the truly massive problem, which I think might be worth mentioning, was the hole that Duke Harrington was standing in front of. It was 6 paces in diameter, and the noise coming from it was unlike anything I had ever heard. It was as if 1,000 miners were working themselves to death, madly swinging pickaxes at the stone until it shattered. The rest of the party arrived just as the elemental sealed the arcane siphons in their own little chamber. I shouted to be heard over the din of rock being ground to powder. "They aren't collapsing the city. They're digging!" The Bishop of Koroth laughed, the otherworldly sound easily carrying above the noise generated by the invisible miners. "Collapsing the city. There will be time for that. First, we must call Koroth and his court to witness our sacrifice and draw up a new covenant." The insane priest's words turned my guts to ice. Suddenly, it all fell into place. This was the loophole. It was Toby who voiced my suspicion. "You're digging a path to the 9 hells? An actual physical tunnel? Are you insane?" Koroth's bishop just grinned. I noticed that his teeth were purple as well. Despite being battered, bleeding, and spent, Toby and Ames started to charge the bishop's position. Rick began an incantation, while Will and myself started to run towards the Duke. The Bishop of Koroth slammed the butt of his ornate staff to the ground. It sent a shockwave through the earth that knocked us all from our feet. Duke Harrington fell to his knees, but continued praying. Even the earth elemental stumbled. Rick's spell was spoiled. Only the evil clergyman remained standing. As we were regaining our bearings, the bishop pointed at the ceiling in front of the now blocked siphon chamber. "Bring it down," he said. The elemental cocked its boulder-sized fist and slammed it into the ceiling. The sound of fracturing stone could be heard echoing throughout the cavern, even over the din of manic arcane mining. Toby had a new target. Once the Minotaur regained his feet, he charged towards the elemental, brandishing his recently acquired war axe. Everyone thought that he would just be a distraction to the stone beast, but the first double-handed swing took a sizable chunk of rock out of the huge elemental's leg. The next swing from the conjured giant wasn't towards the ceiling, it was at Toby's head. Ames stalked up to the bishop himself, hoping that disrupting the elemental's puppet master would cause it to fall apart. The feline's swing, one that normally might have taken the bishop's head off, connected with some kind of physical barrier. Ames's blow rebounded, and the werecat was thrown back 6 paces. The feline shook their head, trying to get the cobwebs out. Will shouted, "Overload the barrier!" The three of us started to throw everything we had at the bishop. For my part, that was an acid bolt, which seemed to make some sort of impact before dripping to the ground. Rick's force bolt caused the shield to glow brightly for a moment, then fade. Will's fireball, carefully aimed so as to explode behind the mad cleric and not catch Ames in the radius, seemed to surround the bishop like an aura of chaotic flame before fading away. All the while, the Bishop of Koroth was chanting. Whatever divine favor he was calling down, it was massively complex. He had been casting his clerical spell since before my acid bolt hit, and was continuing the incantation well after Will's flames had died out. I gripped my teeth. If that shell he was standing in didn't have anti-magic properties, I could have shut him down in an instant. My brain was swimming. I only had 3 spells left, and casting them would cripple my mind. Already I felt the tug of lethargy inside of my head. It wanted to let go of the burden of knowledge. It wanted to rest. I fought down that urge, as it was tantamount to surrender. I drew my dagger and started to move to a position between the bishop and the duke, intentionally leaving some uncertainty as to who my true target was. Meanwhile, the Minotaur was winning. Somehow, he was not only able to dodge the relatively slow blows of the elemental, but he also landed telling blows up and down the creature's legs. The notches and cracks in the elemental's stone limbs were making it unstable. It started to wobble as it moved to pursue the mobile Minotaur. Ames was back in the fight. The fire in the cat's eyes told the bishop, in no uncertain terms, that this was not over. A testing thrust impacted the shield, but this time there was no knockback. Abandoning their usual graceful style, the werecats screamed in fury and started to hammer on the weakening shield with all of their might, over and over again. When the Bishop of Koroth finished his long incantation, nothing seemed to happen for a moment. Then, a vortex of wind and gravity manifested just behind Toby. The purple eldritch portal howled and started to suck in everyone and everything around it. The paladin chopped.